Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards, producer Carol Stafford, Carly Howe. Folks, if we sound remote today, it's because we are. We are in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at Pollinating Our Future, one of the urban agriculture conferences going on here in the United States. Another one is going on in Brooklyn. And so we hope to have people from Making Brooklyn Bloom calling in and checking in today with us as well. Maybe perhaps you can boot them up if they call in and let us know when they're on the boards, Nikki and Dave. Folks, throughout history, cities and farms prospered in a marriage of convenience. Cities had money, farms had food, and everyone was happy. But after World War II, and even before, cities discovered cheap food and plastic bags, and farms discovered the greener pastures of the distant countryside. And so cities and farms divorced. The post-war years became a period of great prosperity for city and farm. Freed from the constraints of having to feed itself, the city burst forth into surrounding farmland with vast tracts of suburbs. The farm, with newly armored technologies of war and abundant supplies of land and petroleum, grew massive in the rush to get big or get out. All was good with the divorce of city and farm, but as the distance between the two continued to grow, a distance now measured an average of 1,500 miles, some in the city began to feel vulnerable, and others began to tire of the cheap food in plastic bags. To serve these few, farms began returning to the city. Their farmers found that reestablishing the relationship between city and farm was not easy, though, as each no longer knew each other's ways. Consequently, there was much groping about in the dark, as it were, between the two. Gradually, city and farm are growing to know each other's ways again, as evidenced by the thousands of farmers' markets springing up around the United States, bringing farms and real food back to the cities. Today we have come to Milwaukee, Wisconsin to ask, can farms and cities prosper together again as they once did for, gosh, thousands of years? Here to help us explore the question, we have Julie Kohler from the Pollinating Our Future. It's a conference put on by Grow Urban, right?
That's it.
Here in the, so talk up, we have this funny little box that we're working with today. Julie, tell us a little bit about your conference here today.
Well, Pollinating Our Future really came out of the desire that it was time for policymakers to understand what was going on the ground, or rather under the ground, in Milwaukee. And to our surprise and delight, it very rapidly became a national event and even an international event.
I met people here from Holland.
And Ghana. UK, mm-hmm. Canada. It's really pretty exciting. Actually, our big loss was three Mongolian mayors who couldn't get their visas here in time.
Wow.
Next year, they will be here.
So why the interest?
Well, the interest is it's amazing.
First tell us about Milwaukee. Because Milwaukee had quite a relationship with food and feeding itself in the distant past.
Yes, Wisconsin used to be a small grain wheat raising state. It's small farms, dairy farms, and we're among the many states that have given way often to the large agriculture with the enormous farms, and so we have seen moved more into corn, more into the factory farms, and there are many people who are starting to say, we need to make a difference. We need to restore a balance. We need to have diversity. We don't want to be a monoculture, either in livestock or in grains. But most of all, people are reclaiming their right to diverse and local foods.
Local foods.
Yes.
Food with its farmer's face on it, we like to call it. So, and Minneapolis, or Milwaukee here, is really taking some interesting strides in developing facilities, the resources for metropolitan agriculture.
Yes. One of the things that a number of us realized about a year ago is that there were a lot of people working on this issue, but they were all separate. And they were working in, if you'll pardon the pun, in their own silos. So we created the Milwaukee Urban Agriculture Network, which we call MUAN, which doesn't sound good, but that's what it is. So, and we felt that how do we make an impact? Because one of the biggest things was that we started getting together of what we all do, but the other was to make ourselves known to local government that this was a force. And it was a growing force, and it needed to be a part of their planning.
Mm-hmm. How do city fathers respond to this notion of bringing farms back to the city?
Well, it's interesting because it was complete confusion. It's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And then it was, oh my God, all the problems that this would cause. Mm-hmm. But we have been persistent, and it's really interesting because last night at our opening conference, we had our Commissioner of City Development, Rocky Marcoux, announce that as a part of the Milwaukee general plan, they are now going to be incorporating green and urban plots into every single one of the districts, and this is a huge
step. Where are they getting the land? I mean,
well, they have, unfortunately, especially in the Rust Belt cities, there is a lot of land, and it's the lots that have been abandoned. These are the places often where the crack houses have been taken down. Especially in the inner cities, we have lots and lots of plots.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue is, the fight has been between development that is solely in order to put houses on and get developers in, as opposed to this movement that says that's not necessarily the highest and best, even though that an urban garden will not bring in a tax base. What it does is it will stabilize a neighborhood and create a neighborhood so that the roots go deep for the people who live there, because they'll work together, you create passive security, and you create a community. So that will stabilize the community perhaps more than simply a new house being built on that lot.
Have you seen, do you have farmers markets?
Oh, and that's one of our constituents, one of the people we brought together. One of our most wonderful farmers market is the Fondy Market, which brings in a lot of the Hmong farmers that have come to Milwaukee. So urban agriculture is also a way of integrating immigrants into their new social fabric, their new urban fabric.
It's really a way of bringing food to people.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And how do the residents of the city look at you? I mean, do they hear somebody's bringing cows into town? Is that what they think? I mean, this is Wisconsin, right? You're bringing cows.
When they think agriculture, they think cows. Actually, the spread of the urban markets is really been wonderful. The green markets. Milwaukee has two or three pages of green markets now if you go online. So it is.
What does that mean, green markets?
From local farmers.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yes. And this is, I mean.
So this is really something that's happening regardless. I mean, this is.
Exactly, and that's why we decided we had to bring together a network and create the network of all the interested people to sit at the table and to coalesce, and then we can become and have become a voice in city planning.
And when you voice together, you heard.
Yes.
And when you voice alone, nobody pays attention.
You're
to
usually
you, right?
Just an irritant.
Yes, go away, leave me alone.
Yes.
Wow. So, is Milwaukee alone?
No, and that's the glory of this conference, is that we really thought it was a way to bring together maybe the people in the state, but instead, we have people from all over the country and really from all over the world. So this will not be our first one. I mean, this is our first one, but it will not be our last one.
And what about Chicago?
Oh, and Chicago is wonderful. One of the daughters of our Potter familias, Will Allen from Growing Power, a 6'7" African American urban farmer.
He's really like a hero, isn't he? He's like a rock star around here.
Yes, absolutely. And his daughter Erica has gone to Chicago, and is just creating wonders in Chicago. There's actually, they're growing cabbages down in at the park just south of the Chicago Art Institute.
Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're in Milwaukee, Wisconsin at Pollinating Our Future, and we're talking with some of the people involved in bringing agriculture back into the, is it fair to call them Rust Belt cities of a heartland?
I think it is.
It is, and turning that rust into green. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Jennifer Blecka, who is a professor of animal husbandry, a human geographer from San Francisco State. So, and she has some really interesting comments about bringing animals back into town. So please do stay tuned. This is The Food Chain, and we will be right back.
Average acre farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back. Michael Olson here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We're at Pollinating Our Future, a program of urban agriculture put on by the good folks of Milwaukee who are bringing green back to their city, turning the rust of the Rust Belt into the green of back to agriculture where they started. We also have with us Robin from Robin Simmons, who is the director of the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. Who is in? Doing the same thing in Brooklyn, right, Robin?
At the Brooklyn Greenbridge Program, which is part of the Botanic Garden.
Oh, good. So we're here in Milwaukee, and we're talking about turning Milwaukee green. And you're in Brooklyn, doing the same thing in Brooklyn, aren't you?
Yes, and I'm. I grew up just south of Milwaukee, so it's really exciting to see how this movement to bring local food into our cities is happening all over the country.
And it is, it seemed to be happening. Was it the farmers market that really started all of this activity that's bringing attention?
I think that had a lot to do with it. I would say, though, that the community gardening movement really fundamental, certainly here in New York City. That vacant land that you were talking about earlier in Milwaukee, well, that's been a problem here in Brooklyn, too, in some of our inner-city neighborhoods, which have experienced blight. 20, 30 years ago, there was a tremendous amount of vacant land, and out of that came the opportunity for community gardeners to really bring it back to life. And as a result of that, a lot of food and local produce started being available in neighborhoods that weren't otherwise being served by grocery stores and retailers. So I think community gardeners deserve a lot of credit for educating people about what they're missing.
Bringing some taste back to the city. Robin, let me ask you a quick question. About 15 years ago when I was researching my book Metro Farm, trying to figure out who is making money in the world with small pieces of farmland, and I went to the Census of Agriculture and learned a most surprising statistic, whereas farmland here in the heartland was making about $300 and some dollars per acre per year, farmland in the metropolitan areas like San Francisco were earning up to $123,000 per acre per year.
And the
most surprising thing of all was that the highest grossing farmland in the United States was in Brooklyn. And I looked at that and I scratched my head, but it doesn't take you long to realize that you're right in the middle of one of the most hungry markets in the world.
That's right. And we have a long tradition here in Brooklyn of feeding the world, which is something that astonishes people when they learn about it. Until 1893, Brooklyn was the second most productive county in the United States in terms of food production. It was second only to Queens, which is another borough of New York City. And so really we were in active agriculture right up until World War II. And it was after World War II that farms began to just completely disappear from Brooklyn. So we have a tradition here of feeding ourselves. And we have 2.5 million people who are very hungry.
That was always the relationship between cities and farmers. You know, cities had money, and farmers had food, and everybody was happy. Do you think, Robin, that cities and farms can prosper once again, as they did for so many hundreds of years?
Well, I think we are in the New York City metropolitan area. There's no question about it. Our extraordinary restaurant scene here depends on farmers who are growing wonderful, diverse vegetables and fruits, you know, within 50 miles of the city. They have to be able to get that produce here quickly in order to serve a very sophisticated palate. And that's been something that's actually really been taking off as food becomes an ever bigger item in the American culture. We have a pretty strong relationship with an ever-growing, stronger relationship with local growers in the metropolitan area.
Okay, here's the toughest question of all. What do you eat in the winter?
That's a great question. And actually, last year at our conference, Making Brooklyn Bloom, which is it's coming up next week, but last year, Joan Gussaw, who's the author of This Organic Life, talked specifically about that. And
mm-hmm.
she only eats what she raises, just about. She's not a complete purist, because really almost nobody in the world is, but she talked about how tough it was to, you know, get through February on the end of the Brussels sprouts and the onions disappearing, et cetera. So certainly we are bringing in food from all over the world to feed New Yorkers. There's no question about that.
But certainly you are starting to grow your own again, as you once did.
Absolutely. And one of the great things about growing food in cities is that we have so many microclimates here. Cities are heat sinks. You know, we all decry the heat island effect, the urban heat island effect. But in fact, since it's a reality, one of the things that we can do is turn it to an advantage as far as growing food is concerned. So it's a great place to set up cold frames, to utilize reflected light and heat from windows, to warm the soil, to be planting things early, to use the natural windscreen effect of buildings to protect plants.
Well, last night here in Milwaukee, we got together at a county park, and they have three big domes there, and one of the domes has a flower garden, and the other dome has an arid desert, and the other dome has a tropical rainforest.
Oh,
pretty neat stuff to see what's happening. Robin, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And your conference is next week, right?
It's next week, and in fact, we share one of the speakers who is who's in Milwaukee this weekend. Mark Winnie is going to be speaking about closing the food gap, and we've got about 17 workshops, and it's all free to the public. We do this every year at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and it's just a really wonderful opportunity for people who are involved in local food networking and growing to get together.
Great. Thank you very much, Robin. Appreciate your appearance with us today on these technically difficult times, but we made it, and you sound great, and thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Folks, this is Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're coming to you live today from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, pollinating our future. When we get back, we're going to meet some very interesting people, starting with Jennifer here, who's a human geographer with San Francisco State, and she studied the urban architecture and bringing animals back to the city. So we're going to talk about bringing animals back to the city. Also have Jack Schmidt, who is the Dean of Urban Agriculture, with whom I've worked for many years. We have Orrin Williams, we have Harry Rhodes, we have a whole cast of characters, and we're bringing food back to the city here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Please do stay tuned, right back after these messages. Hey, we're back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're live today from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, pollinating our future. With me right now, Mr. Jack Schmidt, who is the Dean of Urban Agriculture. I say that because Jack was working in urban agriculture because anybody remembered there was such a thing, right, Jack?
Right.
I think we last worked together at the first ever urban agriculture conference in Philadelphia, right, at the Flower Mart there. Yep. What a show that was. That was a lot of fun. And you're also the president of the Urban Ag Network, correct?
Yep, that is it. Yep.
And what do you do?
Global.
Here's a business card for all of you folks to see.
Well, the Urban Agriculture Network is a information source. It's advocating urban agriculture. And today, of course, when your information source is not like it used to be.
Yeah.
You start with the internet, and then you move on to conferences and other publications. And I'll tell you, it's really responding to all the interest. The explosion of questions and interest statements showing up on the screen every day, it's amazing.
Well, Jack, take us back. You've been looking at urban agriculture not only here in the United States, but all around the world. What place does urban agriculture, metropolitan agriculture, as I like to call it, have in the life of the community around the world? Is this move back to the city something unique to the United States, or is metropolitan agriculture something that we see as the exception rather than the rule?
Well, I think it's very important for people interested and active in urban agriculture in the United States to study the world and see what others are doing. We can learn from them. The leading place to go is Singapore. Singapore is an island. They decided in the 80s to go into agriculture, and they're now the leading place in the world for rooftop food production. They have a biannual conference. Every 2 years they have a conference on food from the roof. Next, flip over to Amsterdam. Amsterdam city plan and zoning is for producing food in the city. They set aside large areas specifically for food production. The food system is entirely integrated. And you can go on like that for one
what
after
about
another.
In the developing world? What place does metropolitan agriculture have in the developing world?
Well, I worked in Tanzania, the government of Norway, and was promoting urban agriculture there with college professors and agriculturists and the ag ministry. They passed a national policy in favor of urban agriculture in 1986, 6 years after I left, and it was phenomenal. When I was there, you saw a few cows and goats in the capital city of Dar es Salaam. Today, 80% of the green leafy vegetables that are consumed in the city are produced within the municipal boundaries, not the metropolitan, within the municipal boundaries.
Right in
boundaries.
The city, then, the city limits
yeah.
stuff.
Poultry, fish, every type of urban agriculture you can find. And the weird thing is, I live in Washington, D.C., in Baltimore, a large city with a low-income population. They have one agricultural extension agent for the city. Dar es Salaam has 70 agricultural extension agents within that city. And the growth is phenomenal, and it has been put on GIS. If you want to see what the urban agriculture there, it's a GIS system done by the World Environmental Organization. So that's one case.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, which is absolutely amazing, is Hanoi, Vietnam. Get away from the Vietnamese war, you go on. Hanoi was, of course, we have McCain, who was there for several years,
right.
9 years, or whatever. And the total system there is very impressive. It's rice, vegetables, poultry, and pigs. And the pig culture is completely melded into the waste of the city and the other. So those two cities are very good studies.
So you, throughout the developing world, you see instances where it's really the exception rather than the rule.
Urban and
metropolitan agriculture is really the rule.
It's a very different nature in terms of the economy, but we can learn a lot from them as to the creative ways they've come up with.
What do you say to people who say that, listen, we got away from agriculture, like me. I was a teenage herbicide, you know? I mean, I weeded so many bean fields when I was a kid. I wanted to run away. I wanted to get away from it. I wanted to so I did. But here I am talking about it, I guess. What do you say to people who don't think we should be doing agriculture, that we should be pursuing higher interests, like what? I don't know, like what, but like something else.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No,
maybe my industry or something.
Yeah, my boyhood is exactly the same as yours. I raised chickens, goats, all kinds of vegetables, fruit, made maple syrup in an urban setting, not maple syrup. So it's exactly the same. I then took an agricultural degree and did landscape design, very, very well. Good. Then I got bored, so I went into city planning. But of course, I couldn't leave it behind.
Right.
So here I am doing urban regional plans and including agriculture in it. But the first urban agriculture project I did was in Calcutta, India, with the Peace Corps. So Peace Corps kids came to me and said, can we work with these refugees from East Pakistan, the civil war in East Pakistan? So the first real project was with East Pakistani refugees. And it was just so impressive. We worked with the city government, the state government, and the national government. So the refugees could use national government land, the Port Authority land. And they just went ahead and they fed themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to sell in the local market and make money as well as feed themselves.
Huh.
So you get very significant...
How do you get governments to cooperate when other people are paying them not to cooperate? I mean, the large companies that don't want to see people taking care of themselves, they have lobbyists and they lobby government, and you're in Washington, D.C., you see this all the time. How do you convince a government to allow you to do these things?
Well, the thing here is, Michael, you have to try every track. If you go to the Department of Agriculture, you make a little bit of headway in community gardens and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, you do much better.
Uh-huh.
They're working with brownfields, they're working with community groups, so you get a more solid support there. If you go over to EPA, we're dealing with climate change and global warming. They're more likely to support you. So the thing is that you don't follow the obvious path with government. You go where you have support, you go where you actually find an entry. And it's worked in many countries.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. This is Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking live from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. That was Jack Schmidt, the Dean of Urban Agriculture. Always fun to be with you, Jack, and not so long again this time. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, as promised, we're going to talk about bringing animals back to the city.
Yeah.
You are invited to participate, but it's really hard to do so today. Phone number is 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Michael Olson. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned. Hey, we're back. Welcome aboard. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain. Today we're coming to you live from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. That's why we sound a little different today, as it were. Right now I've got Jennifer Blecka, Professor Jennifer Blecka, right, from San Francisco State. You're a human geographer?
Yes.
Well, come up to this Ersatz microphone, and what on earth is a human geographer?
Well, I get to explain this pretty often. Geography, they're the physical geographers who talk about mountains and rivers mm-hmm. and climate, and then they're the human geographers, and we talk about the relationships between people and the environment and where people do their activities and why they're and that kind of thing. So a geographer has something to do with urban agriculture because I ask questions about, well, especially about urban livestock, how... livestock have been a part of cities since the very beginning of cities, and in most of the world they still are.
Mm-hmm. But in World War II, we kind of...
Well, I would say it started in the 19th century, pushing
even before
out.
Then, okay.
Because of concerns about sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
In New York, there was a big movement to get the
hogs. Warrens out of there?
Hogs.
Hogs.
They were these hogs that roamed the streets eating the vegetable peelings and horse manure and dead dogs, but the poor people ate the hogs, and they protested when the city tried to get rid of them.
Ooh.
There were hog riots in Manhattan in the 1820s and 1830s.
Wow.
Yeah, so it wasn't until about, I think it was 1860, that they declared the area below 59th Street a hog-free zone. Anyway, but then horses and cows lasted a lot longer. There were, I think it was like 13,000 dairy cows in the city of London until 1910. They're also, because until they invented refrigerated train cars, the milk had to be grown in the city, otherwise it would spoil by the time it got transported in from the countryside.
And I understand that those milk barns were largely developed as a way of taking care of the residue from distilleries.
Yeah, it was a pretty integrated system. A lot of breweries and things like that, they would feed the cows the leftovers from that. I haven't done a study of Milwaukee, but I bet that might have been
at
play here. it wasn't necessarily that great a food for the cows, but things were rough for a lot of people.
Yeah, things were different back then.
Too.
So let me ask you this quickly. Can we bring animals back into modern times, into the city?
They never left.
They never left.
We thought they left. In a lot of cities, they were regulated out. And I think it's really interesting. Somehow in the 20th century, we got the idea that cities were just for consumption and not for production. And so we kept ourselves, and we've kept malls, and we've kept dogs and cats. And I like dogs and cats, but they don't produce anything. And the minute you lay an egg, you have to leave the city. And what a strange way to run a city is that you can't be productive there. So we often think, when we think about people having chickens or ducks or a goat or something in a city, we'll think it's immigrants. But they did that at home. They kind of have these practices of their culture, says they should grow chickens. And so they kind of do it on the sly in the city when they move to the United States. But actually what we see is that there's a very strong growing movement of people who were born in the United States, who never did it before, who live in the cities, across all the classes, who are starting to grow livestock because of the massive and multiple benefits that it brings.
Well, fresh food for one, but what about the government? I mean, how are cities are characterized by monumentally complex zoning laws that drive everybody stark raving mad. And if you're going to start bringing animals back into the city, much less farms, how do you deal with a government that I'm going to lay down the law?
Yeah. Well, I can make a couple points. I actually just completed a small study looking at 101 cities in the U.S. and Canada and their regulations about...
That would be a big study, too.
Okay. Well, hens, roosters, ducks, rabbits, dairy goats, pigs that are not miniature but pigs to eat, and beehives, and looked at whether those cities allowed them, prohibited them, or forgot to mention them.
Mm-hmm.
And remarkably, in the U.S., there were 80 cities in the U.S., and for most of those animals, 50 to 75% of the cities did allow them, with some restrictions. Now, if your city doesn't allow these animals and you want to keep chickens or want to keep a beehive or want to keep ducks or a dairy goat, there are arguments you can make about all the benefits and mitigate the hazards. There can be limits on the number. Cities have regulations about noise, about smells, about disease, about things that they have for dogs. But dogs bark.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't clean up after your dog, it will create odors. All these laws are on the books already, so you can make arguments saying, okay, so maybe we don't need to have roosters, but hens lay eggs whether you have roosters or not.
But I love the sound of roosters in the morning.
Yeah. Well, some cities allow roosters. So go check your city ordinances online. Every city posts their ordinances, and you will find out which of those animals they allow. And then a lot of cities, people who want to keep these animals, are making a movement in cities who don't allow them to change the regulations. Seattle, 3 months ago, decided to allow goats. Vancouver, B.C., 2 months ago, decided to allow beehives. Cities are gradually opening this because of the benefits. There are environmental benefits of growing local food. There are social benefits of neighborhoods coming together and neighbors coming over and visiting
each
other.
But it probably keeps people from going crazy, too, don't you think?
It was remarkable. I interviewed a whole bunch of people who keep chickens in their backyards in Seattle and Portland, and their initial motivations for getting the chickens were very practical. They wanted fresh, healthy eggs. They knew that where the eggs came from and what they'd been eating was healthy. They wanted ethical eggs because they're worried about the poor treatment of chickens in factory farms. They wanted their children to learn about nature and about food systems and life cycles. And they wanted a better impact on the environment, not to be flying in food from all over, and to take their kitchen scraps and feed them to the chickens, and take the chicken manure and put it on their garden, and then take the garden produce and bring it to their kitchen. And they were very excited about this, agro-ecosystem in their backyard. But after having the animals, many people find all these additional social and emotional benefits. They're proud of them. Their neighbors come over to visit. They discover the animals have personalities. They feel a sense of, as I get back to this first point about production and consumption, people are frustrated to feel like as a city resident, what they are supposed to do in our economy is earn money and spend it. Earn, spend, and spend, 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 actually more than they earn and get into debt. And here they get a chance to be productive and to see food come out of the ground and food come from a chicken and food come from a beehive that they had some management of is very satisfying.
That was Jennifer Blecka. I am Michael Olson. This is The Food Chain. Right back. You stay tuned. Welcome back. Michael Olson here. We have 39 hours worth of programming to get in a few minutes here because, folks, we have talent. We're in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We're at Pollinating Our Future, an urban agriculture conference. Folks from all over the United States, actually from all over the world, have come to Milwaukee to turn the Rust Belt green, and we're here having fun with it. I'm reminded of Monday Night Football. All my rowdy friends are here for some fun right now. We're going to start really quickly with Mark Wynn. Mark, you're one of the speakers here today. What are you going to tell these folks here and next week and Making Brooklyn Bloom?
Well, I have the job of telling people that policy counts. That what we got to do is not just be good food consumers and do a good job of eating right and doing our best as individuals to treat the planet right, but we also have to be good food citizens. You know, we got to get engaged at the local level and state level and national level if we want to get the kind of food and food system that we really want.
Okay, I'm going to ask you the same question I've been asking everybody else. How do you change government?
Well, one way that we've been able to change government with respect to food is to start something called food policy councils. And these are organizations made up of people who have a interest in the food system. They're both citizens. They're city people, city employees, the people that run restaurants, people that run supermarkets, farmers markets, etc. And we find that when you get them around the table and they become the experts on the food system and they begin to make important recommendations that can change the way that cities produce food, think about food, and make sure that good food's available to everybody.
So how do people get involved in these councils? How do they start one?
Well, call me.
Good.
But that, other than that...
Do you have a website?
We have a website called foodpolicycouncil.net. And that's a good place to start to get information on how to start a food policy council and how to get some help in doing that.
Well, good. Mark Wynn, I know you have another speech to give, so thank you for dropping in briefly. We're going to turn quickly here to Terry Rhodes, Oren Williams. You two are representing an organization called what?
Growing Home.
Growing Home.
Right.
As in going home? Almost,
almost
growing home?
Almost.
Isn't that what we're doing here? I mean, for millenniums, cities and agriculture grew together. It grew up together. You know, cities had money, farms had food, our farms had, and we all got along. Isn't that what we're doing now? We're growing home like that?
We're growing home, and we're also helping people who need homes. We've started by working with people who are homeless, providing job training, and combining growing food in the city, in and around the city, with job training and creating jobs.
How can people get in touch with you?
Our website, www.growinghomeinc.org.
Growinghomeinc.org. I once did a show from Soledad State Prison in the horticulture program, and although those guys had a home, they didn't have a life, and the horticulture, the agriculture gave them a life, and you could see the difference in their face between those guys who were working the soil and those guys who were lifting the weights. You could just see it.
It's really about transforming people's lives.
Folks, this has been The Food Chain. Michael Olson here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Thank you for joining us today, and remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.